Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this next hour. Happy to have you with us today, and thank you for listening in. We usually have a roundup of the local news at this time. Our newsman, Dennis Hart, is actually on the road driving back to California. He's a snowbird, but no worries. He will begin providing the news again starting next Friday. So next Friday, at the top of Local Talk, you will again be hearing the news. Tomorrow is Ames Pride Fest here in downtown Ames. So let's talk about that a little bit. KHOI will be having a booth at the festival in front of the radio station. So if the weather cooperates, we're going to have our booth lounge. We introduced this last weekend with the Ames Art Fest, brought all our couches out on the street and gave people a place to rest their feet. So we hope to do that again. And we also have lots of information about KHOI. And we have a jewelry making workshop for young people. And we'll have a masseuse. And we have our rainbow under which you can stand and hold up a sign and say, I am somewhere under the rainbow. Our volunteers painted a rainbow this week that will be standing up in the booth that you can stand in front. So we're going to have lots of fun. I don't know what everybody else is doing, but that's what we're doing. And I have two folks with me here who are actually organizers of the event. Tara Andrews.
Yes.
And Mara Spooner.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, Tara and Mara.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ursula.
You're with Ames Pride?
Yes.
So tell us, what is happening tomorrow? Give us the big picture.
Starting at 11 a.m. on Douglas Avenue between 6th Street and Main Street, we're closing Douglas Avenue down, and we're having our event dedicated to the queer community in Central Iowa, in Ames Pride Fest 2018.
Yeah, within that event, we will have a stage here at the corner of Douglas and Main facing north. It'll have programming all day with the Des Moines Gay Man's Chorus, at least a dozen drag performers in three different drag shows, some story time with Miss Jerry from the library, a couple of drag queens will read stories to the kids, and we'll end with a couple of bands and hopefully a big dance party right in front of the studio.
Absolutely.
What kind of band?
There is Free the Snakes, which is a local band fronted by our dear friend Julia, and then Drama Moth out of Chicago, who bills themselves as the LGBT band from outer space.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, they're very fun.
Oh, yeah, you've seen them before?
I haven't, but I've given their band camp a good listen.
Yes, all listened to them in our meetings.
Yeah.
So you are saying there's going to be lots of fun tomorrow?
Oh,
absolutely.
Absolutely. We have nearly 60 vendors, KHOI included, including four food trucks, many local churches, nonprofits. There'll be a lot of opportunity to buy merchandise, stickers, buttons, socks, shirts, all kinds of things.
This is the second annual festival, is that right?
The second year, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
First year you were in Banshell Park?
Yes.
We were. Uh-huh. Last October we had our inaugural Pride Festival at Banshell Park in mid-October in a very stormy fall day with rain, lightning, thunder, and we all just kind of shared Banshell Swamp together. But we had over 400 people in attendance, so we are expecting to at least double that tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved it to the street downtown here.
Yeah, so even if it does rain, it won't be a super mud swamp.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And our goal in that was not only to be in downtown Ames proper and right next to one of our main collaborators, the Ames Public Library, but to be as physically accessible as possible. Mm-hmm. That grass is difficult and mud is worse. Right. So being on concrete helps us be more physically accessible. We also will have sign interpreters for our stage all day, so interpreting all of the lyrics and spoken word happening on our stage to just try to make our event be as accessible to as most people as possible.
It sounds like you've really done a lot of thinking and analyzing from the last
event. We've tried.
You really thought this one through.
Kind of tried to see our event from as many lenses as we're able.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like fun is on the agenda. What
100%.
Is the overarching, why all this work and effort and excitement?
Just to show as many people as possible that they are included here in Ames. We want to have, like Mara was saying, we try to be as inclusive as possible, and that's our main goal, is just to have everybody that we possibly can come out and celebrate with us.
So this is a festival of inclusiveness.
Absolutely.
coming from the gay and lesbian and bisexual, transsexual community,
mm-hmm.
basically saying, include us and we include you.
You're yeah. welcome here, exactly.
And mm-hmm. to be visible, how important it is to be visible, to validate those in our community, and that there are still places, you know, near us that this, where this would not be possible. And in a time not too long ago here where this kind of event would not have been a thing that we would have been able to do with so much support.
After I speak with you, we're going to play an interview with somebody from the gay community mm-hmm. talking about how things were in the past, the background of why an event like this ends up occurring.
Sure.
So we'll look back a little bit. Before we do that, tell us a little bit about Ames Pride. You're from Ames Pride.
Yes.
Which is a community group or a university group or what is
We're a nonprofit here in Ames. So Ames Pride came about last year. It was just kind of after the election season of the fall of 2016. A group of us had all of this energy and anxiety and need to organize around a common positive purpose. There's a lot of anxiousness and the need to do something productive rather than rally against something. So mm-hmm. a few of us came together and like, well, there's not a lot of organization in the queer community outside of Iowa State's campus where they have many, many groups and that community is just very organized. But the rest of us aren't. And so we're like, well, we could have a festival. So we started planning a festival and we're having a lot of fun. And a few more organized and dedicated members of our group decided to create a federally recognized nonprofit. So Ames Pride is a 501c3 nonprofit, operating within all of those, you know, opportunities and constraints that nonprofits have. And Ames Pride Fest is our signature event.
Are you involved with the university or are you strictly a community group?
No, we have involvement with the university. In fact, many of our board members are members at the university, faculty and staff and so forth. So we're very, very intertwined with the university, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you're essentially a community group.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Yeah, we're involved in the university in that some of the people we work with mm-hmm. also work with the university, and we work with that community closely.
Mm-hmm. It's like KHOI. Kind
exactly.
of the same
exactly.
Thing.
Yeah. The same thing.
Yeah. You're an independent group,
right?
But
community
you partner
group.
With many other community organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how's this year been since you've been an incorporated organization?
Yeah,
this year
incredible.
Has been really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Really? Explain.
Well, we are producing our second annual Pride Fest tomorrow, which is an amazing thing for us. And we have added a handful of other events. So we do a monthly Queers and Beers as a queer happy hour at the London Underground on the second Sunday of every month from 3 to 5. And the Ames Pride Board, which we are both members of, is always right now looking for new opportunities to organize and create events and visibility and fundraise. Tara's been working on a project with a local faith group.
Yes, with Collegiate United, we have a trans and non-binary clothing swap coming up, and we're going to start accepting donations for that actually at Pride Fest, and there'll be a donation boxes at the Ames Pride booth as well as the Collegiate United booth.
Explain
trans
what
and non-binary.
Happens.
Yeah, clothing swap. Essentially, we're just going to have the community is going to be donating, hopefully, the clothing that we need. We're going to have some hairstylists there, some makeup artists, and a tailor, and we're going to be providing like fashion advice and clothing advice and shopping advice and whatever clothing, especially we're concentrating on students, incoming trans and non-binary students, so that we can give them the clothing and materials they need to be the people that they want to be.
That's very important in that sometimes someone who is beginning a transition doesn't have the resource to buy clothing that affirms their gender or doesn't have the ability to alter the clothing they own to fit them in a way that they feel comfortable.
So in other words, if you have a male body
mm-hmm.
and you're transitioning to being a female, you still have a lot of clothes for men, right?
Right. And so you might not have the resource to buy a whole new wardrobe.
Uh-huh. And especially since your body's going to be changing in different stages. So mm-hmm. It's not like you could just buy a set of clothes,
yeah.
right?
Because you have to go out and, just like Mara was saying, buy a whole new wardrobe, but then mm-hmm. not just once, every time your body changes, which is constantly for the first, you know, depending on how you transition, for many years. And so every time your body changes, you need to buy a new wardrobe. And so it's way more effective if you have the resources and you know the right people to have a tailor and have your clothes altered and just kind of have it to where everything fits you how it's supposed to.
And especially for young people that... You know, maybe they're a student, they're 18, 19 years old, they've just left their parents' house for the first time and are finally feeling the freedom to live their lives as who they are. And maybe they can't rely on their parents for a resource or even talk to them about what their life is becoming. So to be able to have a space for them to do that amongst their peers is really important.
And maybe even they don't feel comfortable going into like the mall or Kohl's or anywhere and just shopping for clothing.
Mm-hmm.
To affirm their gender. This way they can go to a friendly place and everyone is friendly and like them mm-hmm. and there to help them.
Mm-hmm. It's just so it's a supportive environment.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's a very specific and very practical project.
I agree.
This is a very practical issue.
Yes, absolutely. It's Jen Hebben from Collegiate United approached us sort of with the idea, and her and I have been collaborating on it, and it's something that's mm-hmm. obviously very near and dear to my heart, and it makes me just makes my heart sing just to be able to work with her and help and make this happen.
Mm-hmm. And when you say obviously, what do you mean by that? Because this
obviously,
is radio.
Yes, it is radio, yes. So obviously as a trans woman, and especially being a very tall trans woman, clothing, especially when I first started out, was very difficult to find. It's not just clothing. It's like finding your own style and your own fashion, everything. If you've done it one way, like I had for 37 years, all of a sudden overnight, you want to change and do something different. So it's very near and dear to me because when I first started transitioning, didn't have those resources.
Those were problems you were facing.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I know exactly how it feels.
I guess we need to move on in a minute, but I'm just curious. So you just kind of shared a very personal place you're coming from. I'm curious for both of you what you're getting out of being in Ames Pride and just, you know, why you're taking the time and energy to do these things.
It's really empowering and humbling to be able to serve a community that we are both parts of and that we know from our own experience and seeing the rest of the world is genuinely underserved. And to be able to, you know, have an organization and throw a festival, a celebration of our lives shared with everyone else's, is something for which I am incredibly grateful. I personally enjoy being very busy and working toward goals that are shared with people, and it's been incredibly rewarding to organize this festival with this team.
Yeah,
it's an amazing team of people.
Mm-hmm. We've been given a really incredible opportunity to help other people like us and other people who are not like us be included in a community that previously they weren't able to be included in. So yeah,
okay.
We're super happy for it.
Thank you. Well, give us the specifics again about the festival tomorrow.
Absolutely. So tomorrow we're opening up everything at 11 a.m. We're closing Douglas down between 6th Street and Main Street. There's going to be a stage set up at the corner of Main and Douglas there. And all the way through to the public library, we're going to have kids' activities in the library. We're going to have all kinds of vendors, food vendors outside. It's going to be an incredible time.
Thank you so much for coming in. I've been speaking with Tara Andrews and Mara Spooner, organizers of Ames Pride Fest 2018, along with a team of other people. And they are from Ames Pride, a new and ambitious nonprofit organization in Ames, Iowa.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
What we're going to do next is listen to an interview that Susan Franson recorded yesterday with Keith Schrag, who's a member of the Ames community, a gay man. And he's going to talk about what that meant in the past and his own story of himself.
Well, it's interesting to have for me to have this chance to reflect on what's been going on in terms of queer identity, queer rights, and culturally what's been happening. And I was thinking about the impact of history and remember a time when there was a queer bar, gay bar, in Des Moines on the south side, just on the south side of the river. And There were two men, professional men from Des Moines, who used to come up to Ames regularly for the gay gathering here. And they and a few others in a week similar to Pride Week were featured at that bar. And one evening was a history. And this would have been, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the 80s. Jack and Bob were their names. And one had been in personnel administration in the Des Moines school system, and the other, I forget what his professional involvement was. But that evening at the bar, we were talking about what was going on in the various decades, in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And we went decade by decade. And there were some young people, if this was in the 80s, I would have been in my 40s. And there were some people who were late teens, early 20s. And as a result of that, they were totally amazed. And they said, we had no idea that there was a history like this. All we knew was our own part of the story. And we're part of a long history of people working at this and experiencing. And it was a magical moment for us to share how meaningful this look at history was for these young folks who didn't have a perspective. And for me, to know what was going on in the decades before I had much involvement and awareness, because Jack and Bob were 20 years older than I or somewhere in that. And I remember some of the first gatherings, I didn't know whether I could go or not. And I was told it was safe, but I was married and I had children and I was a pastor, part-time pastor of a young developing group here. And in that group, we were studying human sexuality and focusing on inclusion of what we now call GLBTQ folk. But that was very cutting edge, and it was something that in our denomination, our Mennonite district, was not being done. And I was used to being involved in my pastoral work with fringe people, quote, minority folks and people on the edge. And in my peace and justice work, I was a conscientious objector. And, of course, being a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War days was very controversial. So I was used to, based on my own particular faith and my understanding of Scripture, focusing on God's love for all people. But knowing my own preference or increasingly awareness that my natural proclivity was deep, intimate relationship with men, although I had thought clearly that God was leading me to a woman years before and that would save me from this evil of homosexuality, there was this all this conflictedness about what I could do professionally and personally. And so when this opportunity came that the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames was making available a place that was called Safe Space for us to meet. Nobody else in the community would have access to the building when we were there. And that meant that it might even be possible to drive up to the parking lot without being known or, quote, outing ourselves. It was still a big risk, but it was an amazing service that was being given. And I don't remember exact dates when that gathering started, but I do know that it was before I came out to my kids, and I came out to my kids when they were in high school. My wife had known increasingly of my proclivity, or what was that was the term used at that time. And so those gatherings were times when, yes, we would use only first names, and we met to tell our story. And it was such a relief to be able to tell somebody our story who understood. And we didn't, it was a small group, I don't recall. It got bigger in time and people came from Des Moines. But it was an amazing time when we could take a breath for a short period of time and know that in some way, at some level, we were understood. And we were not considered evil or dangerous or anti-spiritual. Reflecting on it now, I'm amazed at what a breath freedom that was, that I think it's hard for many people who haven't had to deal with that kind of extremely strong public civic pressure. It'd be very hard for them to understand. So there's that, and of course the group expanded from there then on, and eventually felt we could include women, and then this strange group, bisexuals, and we had struggles with increasing because there was a sense of trust and warmth that had developed, and each time it expanded, it meant taking a risk, but it always turned out to be good. Then we had a woman who became president. I think the first woman who became president of the group was bisexual, and having a bisexual person in the group and then becoming president. I mean, for her to become president took a lot of affirmation in the group, but it was a progression of understanding and trust. In those years, I was beginning to work more on counseling and getting some additional training at Iowa State that would certify me as a marriage and family therapist. And later in 93, when Iowa developed a licensure program for marriage and family therapists, I was in the early months of that formal grouping that was recognized professionally in the state. And in the process, whether it was at state level or national level of our American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, I became increasingly involved in helping to develop a task force, we called it. That was a very conservative mental health profession at that point, but that would help the board and the structures of the organization to become more open to people who were, quote, at that time called homosexuals. And so the culture of the country and the culture of Iowa as well was quite foreign and in many ways hostile to gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer folks, as we now tend to call ourselves in some areas. It was during that time that to be able to speak for ourselves eventually, which I did in the board of my American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy in 1990, and find that there was willingness to hear a member's I was also a supervisor in the organization and could supervise new folks who were training, and to find that the group even was glad and welcomed my voice, that was strange, because in the church at that time, the church that I represented, Mennonite Church, which was very different from the Unitarian Universalists, who were quite open. But like most other denominations at that time, we were pariahs or people to be most distrusted. Kind of the common sense in the culture was that all we were out for was sex and to pervert young boys. And those are still painful thoughts that strike deep sorrow in me, even as I state those terms, because they were such whipping tools that increased the sense of shame and rejection and unacceptability that we as gay men had in those days. Which brings me to 1990, as in Ames here, Ames Boone, a dramatic event that became national and international news. Before then, I had resigned pastoring, and our little Mennonite congregation had been ejected after a lot of anguish and talking together on sides of leadership and so on from the Iowa-Nebraska Mennonite Conference, because we were welcoming of LGBTQ folk. And so in the late 80s, I was part of the group that was involved when our little congregation was ejected from the conference, from the district. And I became clear at that point also that I could no longer consider that perhaps God had created me as I was. Created in God's image always meant straight, of course. And the scriptures, there were, quote, seven clobber scriptures that were often used to condemn us and or our behavior, so to speak, in those days. And in some groups still are used. So I felt very condemned, and also a dismal failure because I wasn't able to, in our church terms, able to overcome the besetting sin of homosexuality. So by the late 80s, by 87, about the time that I was finally deciding, Rhoda and I had been talking about what we were going to do and the possibility of divorce. I had married Rhoda because I had a direct experience from God. That's my experience of this. That God led me to a woman. Now, what I had thought, hoped, understood was if God led me to a woman, then I would no longer be, quote, tempted to want to have intimate relationships, sex, with a man. And I thought, oh, great. Finally, something's here to save me from this wretched condition that I'm in that I can't, no matter what, I can't shake. Well, interesting. Because some months after the marriage, lo and behold, attractive man caught my eye, and my heart dropped. Wasn't God faithful? Had God deserted me? My father had been a pastor, and was in those days yet. His father had been a pastor. I come from a long tradition of service to God in the Mennonite tradition. It goes back to Switzerland in the 1600s. At any rate. So it was time. I had to bite the bullet. I had the best counselor in all Des Moines, in all Iowa, to work with for some time. And Larry is still alive, bless him, and straight man, United Methodist minister who advocates for people who happen to be GLBT. At any rate, I got to the point where I experienced a relationship that was deeply spiritual with a man. And it included affection and sexual affection. And by that point, I could no longer provide any sexual activity service to my wife, who really enjoyed. I couldn't honor her. And so the dilemma was then what is the best thing to do? And I got counsel from an amazing Catholic priest, pastor friend, and other folks. I'm going to have to deal with the marriage question. Susan, I had covenanted before God and 150 guests, family, and wonderful people from Canada and the U.S. to be in committed, loving, caring relationship with Rhoda until life parted us. And I was talking about breaking that covenant. It seemed to me that the best thing I could do was to... I couldn't live in secret anymore. I had to be honest and open with who I am. And I had to release Rhoda so that she could have a relationship with a man who really appreciated her as a woman and wanted her as a woman, sexually as well as in other ways. So, in late 87, I told my folks that. I don't know. I don't recall whether it was... Oh, yes, it was in a phone call. And Dad said, well, Keith will be praying for you. To me, that's the deepest, most loving, most caring thing my dad could say. And a few days later, there was a phone call from him. Maybe I told him that they came to visit us. It doesn't matter. They came from Virginia at that time. Dad was 80-something years old, 81 or 2. And in the phone call, Dad said, and there was a message on the tape, and I called him and he said, I found it. I said, what did you find, Dad? He said, and of course he was reading scripture as well as praying. And in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's reference made to eunuchs in the tradition of faith. Eunuchs are men who can't function sexually because some have been made that way by men. They've been castrated, in other words, or were born that way. And they were full participants in the household of faith, whether it was a Jewish tradition or Christian tradition. Dad said, I found it. That's all it takes. My dad was looking for any way that he could to accept me. What more can a parent give a child?
That was Sister Sledge with We Are Family. And Aladdin, our engineer, told me while the music was playing that he actually went to the same school that Sister Sledge went to in...
Elementary school.
In elementary school in Pittsburgh?
Philadelphia.
Hats off to our engineer who went to the same grade school as Sister Sledge in Philadelphia. And before that, we heard from Keith Schrag, who shared his own story and journey as a gay man. And we thank Keith for sharing so openly his story with the rest of us. While he was speaking, he also shared his experiences of some of the political realities for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transsexual members of our community. as they have evolved in the past. He was telling the story in anticipation of Ames Pride Festival that's happening this weekend here on Douglas Avenue on Saturday afternoon. And speaking of change, you may have noticed an advocacy group who's been very busy here in town. They're called Next Gen, and it's a group that is focused on registering young people to vote and to be able to voice their opinions of how they want things to evolve into the future. They were at Iowa State recently registering young people, students to vote. Two new reporters, Cece Iverson and Kiera Chester, went out to see what they were up to. Here is their report. Let's listen to what happened.
Kiera Chester brings to us some information from Iowa State University and an organization that brought to us ice cream and voter registration.
Sure. So the first question that we're going to ask you, what is this that you're doing with the voting?
Yeah, so we are out here. We're talking to college students here on Iowa State's campus. We're handing out ice cream to everyone and also asking them if they're registered to vote, making sure that all their information is up to date, that they're prepared to vote in November. And then also we're having people fill out pledge to vote cards, which are just, we want to know what issues that young people care about. We want to be an organization that acts on those issues and make sure that we're getting electing people that represent us. And yeah, so that's what we're out here doing.
Most definitely, most definitely. And why is this important to you?
Yeah, it's important to me. I am a very politically involved person. I have been my whole life. There are a lot of issues that I care about, such as affordable health care, the cost of college, a lot of things going on in our country right now that I want to make sure that we can change. And I know a lot of young people like me want to change as well. And so we're just out here making sure that we take all the enthusiasm that young people have and we can channel it into something like voting to actually make a difference.
Most definitely. Thank you so much for that valuable information.
We are here with an organization called Next Gen America, specifically Next Gen Iowa here in the state of Iowa. So if you want to get in contact with us, our website is nextgenamerica.org. You can go on there, put your contact information and get in touch with us. We also have a Facebook page that you can reach out to us on too, where we post Next Gen Iowa, in which you can see all the cool stuff that we're doing across the state and making sure that you can get involved with us and we can make sure young people are registered to vote and get out to the polls in November.
So what are the dates that voting will start?
Yep, and so early voting here starts in the state of Iowa in October, and so Election Day is November 6th. So we have early voting. You can go to your county auditor's office, depending on what county you live in, and vote early there. You can also request an absentee ballot via the mail and fill that out for wherever you live. And yeah, that's Election Day is November 6th, so making sure that if you can't early vote or you don't request an absentee ballot, you have a plan to vote on Tuesday, November 6th.
Okay, one more question. What benefits can the youth have from voting? And if you can have some encouraging words to offer, what can you offer to the youth?
Yeah, definitely. Well, young people are the largest voting bloc in this country. Being the largest voting bloc, we still don't vote in the numbers that we need to. I know that young people are excited. I've been out here talking to young people, and I know that the way that we can make a difference is voting for people that are going to actually represent us. Politicians don't necessarily care about the same issues that young people care about because we don't vote. And so we need to make sure that we go out, we vote for the people that are going to represent us, that are going to care about the issues that we care about, and that way we can make sure that young people's voices are heard. Voting is the best way to do that.
I see that you're standing in the voter registration line. Why is voting important to you?
Voting is important because apparently, like, most of the youth doesn't vote anyway, so it's mostly the older generations who vote. And I think that's a good idea if you have different beliefs than the older generations.
Okay, so if you're voting, what benefits are you looking to reap from this?
Just for them to hear, like, the general opinion from the younger generations and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you so much. No
problem.
Appreciate that.
And that was Cece Iverson and Kiera Chester interviewing Next Gen, young people's voter advocacy group that you will see very active around Ames and all of Iowa in the next few months to come as we approach election time. And this is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for listening in. I'm here with Aladdin, your engineer. He's bringing you the sound of my voice and all of the various interviews with members of the communities that we always have the privilege to bring to you here on Local Talk as we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This past week, we at KHOI had a particularly sad event happen at the station. We lost our beloved landlord this past week on September 25th, Dennis Jones. our landlord passed away. He was 67 years old, was just about the finest landlord that anybody could wish for. And we are terribly, terribly sad. Dennis had a distinguished career at the Animal Disease Laboratory with the USDA as operations manager, was recognized for his innovative and high-quality work there. It was nationally recognized. But we just know him as the guy who gave us this fabulous building here on Douglas Avenue and has treated us like gold ever since we've been in the building and has been a true friend. And so we are terribly, terribly sad and wish to extend our condolences to his family, his friends, and quite frankly to ourselves, because we've lost somebody that has meant a great deal to us. And he loved the building that we were in, the Ames Pantorium. I have to say for myself, every day I feel like I just won the lottery when I get to walk into this really, really lovely historic building on downtown Ames that many of us who grew up in Ames knew as the dry cleaners until Dennis bought the building and began to restore it to its really beautiful state that it was originally built in. We do have a recording of an interview that we made with Dennis many, many years ago, and he talked to us a little bit about the building, and I'd like to share that interview with him so that we can bring Dennis, in his own words, back to KHOI. We have a very special guest with us today here in the studio. We have started a new thread of focus on KHOI, which we call Hidden Treasures of the Community. And this person is that. Dennis Jones is our landlord. And we are very pleased that we've been able to convince him to step out of the background for a few minutes and take just a little bit of time out of his busy schedule to be on the air with us. Welcome, Dennis Jones.
Thank you.
Dennis, we've known each other now for almost 3 years, or a little more than 3 years. You had only recently bought the building when we talked to you about moving in.
Yes. The previous tenant was a dry cleaner, which the building was actually built for way back in 1925. And following that, well, I bought the building, and the cleaning establishment that was there at the time moved on, and it was vacant. And one Saturday morning, Ursula was peering at the window, and we became acquainted.
And you and your wife were on a scaffold, as I remember, painting,
yes,
doing something on the ceiling of the building.
I think it was on coat number 3 or 4, something like that.
Dennis, is this your first commercial building?
Yes, yes. This is the only one that we've ventured into.
Tell us about buying the Pantorium. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I've been looking for a place that our local bicycle club could re-energize ourselves and sell used bicycles like we had done before for several years. And the club had kind of petered out a little bit, and we were looking for a spot. I have materials in my basement and places. Friends' basement and garage were overrun, and so we were looking for a spot. And this building had potential for both rent and income that way. Was a beautiful building, or at least I thought it was, and so it just kind of intrigued me at a time when I was ready to invest a little bit of money.
So you're saying that the bicycle club was really a major motivation for buying the building?
Well, it was a motivation. I'm not sure that it was a strongest motivation.
Uh-huh.
Probably looking at investing and planning ahead towards retirement and something I could work on was actually a little more of a motivation.
Uh-huh. And I've always gotten a very strong sense from you just that the building's presence itself was something that inspired your interest, that you liked the historical aspect of it and kind of just the beauty of this building.
Yeah, and some of that came about after I bought it. I learned shortly after that the building was actually part of the long-term plan for the Ames Historical Society. They had it in their vision that they might expand here into the building for a display area. Actually kind of surprised me, but it was intriguing. And in that process, I got a hold of a copy of the set of the plans that they had. And I learned, as I looked at the plans, I recognized the drawing and the drafting style that was on the plan. And did some further research. I used to work at Iowa State University in the Agricultural Engineering Building, Davidson Hall, and I recognized that the plans had been drawn by the same person or the same firm. And so I did some further research, and Alan Holmes Kimball was the architect involved. And there's a history back there that, he designed the reconstruction of Davidson Hall back in roughly the 30s, I believe. And he also designed this building, along with several other structures around town.
So the Pantorium really is historically significant in terms of architects that were in this community.
Yeah, and it also shows up on the study that the historical architectural historian Will Page did of the downtown buildings. And it represents a style or a going away from the Victorian style of the old buildings to ones where you have the glass front, transom windows, the kickboard area out front that was all part of or consistent with the facade program that City of Ames is trying to put forth as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really a revelation. This building was, I don't know, I think the word is neglected for many years. I grew up in this town bringing my dry cleaning here and kind of assuming that this building wouldn't last too long because it was in pretty bad condition. And being in the building now and seeing the work you're doing here has really been a revelation because it's a really very beautiful building and very solidly built.
Yes, it is real well built. Mm-hmm. Terrazzo floors, concrete foundation, lots of things that aren't present in a lot of the downtown buildings around here, or at least several of them don't have that kind of luxury. The basement, 17-inch thick concrete walls, elaborate things, the structural floor system between it, and so on.
The fir vault in the basement?
Yes, yes.
There is a fir vault in the basement. Which you said used to be actually the coal chute, right, or the coal room.
It looked like it was the original coal room for the building, and then at some time or other it changed the furnace probably to oil. Mm-hmm. And at that time, then they blocked that wall off, and there's a big steel, looks like a bank vault door.
It does, yes.
Into
it's kind of fancy.
And our understanding is that was where, in older days, people that would have furs and valuables that they need to keep in a secure area and also keep free of moths and so on. That way would bring them to the dry cleaner and store them over the winter, mm-hmm. or I guess maybe over the summer.
It's interesting to think that there were enough people in Ames with fur coats that it warranted a fur vault.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Well, now, I guess we don't have a history of knowing if that paid off or not, but certainly the improvement was there.
When we moved into the building, the first thing that everybody said to us all the time was, "You're not taking that sign down, are you?" And so this is just to say, no, the sign is here to stay. In fact, one of these days we're going to make sure it gets lit up again.
Yes.
But when I was young, I always assumed that this was a dry cleaning building in an old movie theater because it had this ostentatious neon sign on the front that said Pantorium, which I thought sounded kind of grandiose. But apparently, the operative word in that is pant. And in fact, a pantorium is a dry cleaner's.
Right. Apparently, it was a word developed somewhere in the teens or 20s or thereabouts. And it derives from the word pants, or a Latin word, actually. And of the pants, I think, is
the
term that it has. But it apparently was a commercial brand name or business name that a firm used associated with that. There are pantoriums around the country, although as you Google and search them, there are very few and far between.
Yeah.
Most of them, of course, gone out of business, but was there. Even in my hometown of Atlantic, I found a 1915 article that talked about the Atlantic's best pantorium.
Uh-huh.
Which was clearly named a dry cleaner's. It wasn't identified as a pantorium in the name,
mm-hmm.
but the pantorium was the function that it mm-hmm. that it achieved.
Well, and we still do have people coming in with their laundry. It's petering out bit by bit, but and then we have people coming looking for their laundry, too. So slowly but surely, the past fades away. Did you ever think that you would have a radio station in your building?
No. Well, we, hadn't really thought too much about what our tenant would be. We saw that this is a viable area, that downtown is growing and becoming more viable down here. So we had faith that there would be somebody that would be mm-hmm. interested in it. And I had heard I'm a member of a Kiwanis Club, and Roger Parmenter mm-hmm. had actually given us a program about a year earlier. And the morning that you introduced yourself to us, well, it kind of all connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, I think, from all of us for not only letting us have this beautiful home, and it has made all the difference in the world, but also just for being the kind of landlord you are. I mean, I can't think of one person that just doesn't love it when you walk into the building, you know. And
that feels good, too.
Yeah, it's great. It's really great to be your tenant, and you've been just a wonderful landlord. Thank you. I just wanted to mention real briefly, you are actually a chief of operations at the Animal Disease Laboratory. Is that correct?
Actually, I'm phasing into retirement, so my replacement has now started out there. And I'm trying to do some training for him and so on. But, yeah, I was the chief facility engineer mm-hmm. at the National Animal Disease Center, National Centers for Animal Health.
Even though in our world, you being our landlord is really what makes you the biggest treasure in the world, I have a feeling that the real contribution you've made lies much more in that area in your career at the laboratory. And you were before that at Iowa State, right?
Yeah, it's been a number of years ago. In Iowa State, though, so.
So can we get you to come back sometime after you've retired to talk about, give us some understanding of what's happening at the Animal Disease Laboratory?
And oh, certainly, and we could arrange for the director or other folks out there that would be glad to tell the community more about what goes on out there.
Okay.
We don't get asked very often, and it's nice to share what progress we make out there.
Yeah, and it's actually a pretty significant part of our community.
It
so
is now.
It would be nice.
Sure.
It'd be nice to kind of pull that into the awareness here at the station.
Yeah, in the last 10 years, the government's made roughly $500 million worth of investment in the facilities out there. So it's a big facility now.
Uh huh. How long were you working there?
I'll finish out 24 years this spring.
24 years.
Yeah.
So it's Can you just share maybe one thing about your understanding of it as an institution?
Well, they do applied research, so they're really looking at trying to solve disease problems in livestock and significantly important diseases to livestock as well. And then they were also heavily involved in the avian influenza outbreak, determining what the patterns are with that, diagnosis of those, and helping to develop strategies.
Okay. So. Well, thank you, Dennis. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I really appreciate the work you've done to make this building increasingly beautiful for us.
Well, thank you.
And the spirit within which you do it.
Yeah. And you've been great tenants, and we want to keep that going as well. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that was Dennis Jones, our landlord, who passed away last week on September 25th. And Dennis, I cannot express how much we are going to miss you. We just really never had one crossword with our landlord, and I don't think many people can actually say that, but we really can. And in true form, I just saw him out there last week in front of the building fixing our awning. So he took care of us before he left this world. And again, our condolences to his family, his wife, Cindy. Cindy, we're thinking about you. Earlier in the show, we heard from Keith Schrag and Tara Andrews and Mara Spooner from Ames Pride. And we also heard an interview with Next Generation Voter Registration Group. And this has been Local Talk. I have been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Local Talk airs today at 7 a.m. noon, 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. here at 89.1 FM. And also remember that you can hear recordings of this show and information about the people you heard about on our website, khoifm.org. Also remember that KHOI streaming live online at khoifm.org. So tell your relatives about KHOI who don't live in the area. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. Local Talk was engineered today by Aladdin, the intrepid Aladdin, who moved heaven and earth to get here this morning because his car died, he tells me. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you and we will welcome you. Come and join the Local Talk team. We always like new voices. Remember that you, the listener, are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting Kenny G, November 28th at 8 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu. That's center.iastate.edu.